Richard Fieldhouse, and welcome to the August 2018 edition of the NASGP's Sessional GP magazine. And I'm putting this together, actually. I'm actually on holiday at the moment in the hills of Prestine in the Welsh Borders, so you may hear the odd noise from a sheep or a tractor going past or a buzzard flying over, but I'll carry on regardless. So this magazine starts off with the second part in a three-part series on errors and mistakes and biases and how we report them in the NHS. And this one, this second part, is about the black box thinking element of an approach to these errors and mistakes. So in the first article, I talked about the differences between the intuitive, fast system, system one type way of thinking, which is a wonderful, beautiful, naturally evolved way for us to function as humans. And with all its natural amazingness, a lot of it is based on shortcuts and biases that we make, and we're not infallible. And we're doing this most of the time. Yet, I guess the second part of the article is about how our approach to mistakes, despite them being expected, and is to suddenly kind of find someone to blame for them, and not take responsibility so much for those errors, but most importantly, to not approach errors and mistakes in the scientific way, despite the fact we know they're going to happen, and actually take this part of the article argues, is to take a more scientific aviation industry style approach to these mistakes and errors, and using them to actually learn from them and change our behaviour. And once we've identified what those are, to use the marginal gains to stop them happening or make them less likely to happen again. And it's the marginal gains part of the argument we'll do in the third part of the series. So so this article very much goes along that you may well have read it, the Matthew Syed book on black box thinking, and in there are the two stories which it hinges upon, which is that of comparing mistakes and errors made in the aviation industry and our approach to them, compared to that of the NHS, and the health industry across the world, not just the NHS. And largely it's about us as doctors and this sort of the cognitive dissonance that, again, is a very, very natural thing to happen, but it's being aware of it and making sure we don't fall foul of its side effects. So that's the first article. It's quite a long read, and there are links back there to the first article if you haven't already read it. Then we go on to the second article, which is on pension tiers and indemnity thresholds from Liz, from Honey Barrett. And last edition, Liz Densey did an article on the tax thresholds. So this is the, you earn a certain amount of money, and when you get above a certain threshold, you pay a different level of tax. And there are various sort of traps and pitfalls in that system. But Liz received an email from an NESGP member pointing out that she hadn't gone into other different types of tiers that can also cause, financially relevant, and from, particularly from an accountancy tax point of view. So Liz has put the second article based on that very helpful email exchange. And this is about the pension tiers and certainly over the last 6 months, an awful lot of GPs, particularly GP locums, have fallen foul of the annualisation rules, the pension rules. So, and Liz's top advice here is basically you must not have a gap of 3 months or more in locuming. Otherwise, you will then be, you'll have to pay pension for no added benefit. I had a much higher pension tier, several factors of extra pension, and you actually end up working more and actually taking home even less money for no extra benefit. So it's being aware of those tiers and when they kick in. And then the other threshold, of course, is indemnity. Your indemnity organisation that you're paying, if you can, again, particularly if you're someone like a locum who doesn't have a fixed number of sessions, you can't predict ahead. Being wary of the fact that if you don't suddenly step into the next tier up, your indemnity can literally double, and you then have to spend the next month or so. Two months earning just to pay off that extra indemnity. So arguably you could have just stopped working and earned more. So it's being wary of those and having those targeted. If you're a locum deck user, you will be familiar with the bookkeeper. And bookkeeper is a sort of a back part of locum deck. Comes with your own SGP membership that sits there ticking away silently, and as you put in your sessions and invoices and your pensions, it's collecting all that data. It collects all your travel data and your distances and your mileage, and it separates your visit mileage to your commute mileage, which is approached differently for tax purposes. I mean, we've asked Liz about whether we can start putting in a meter, as it were, to look at these different tiers as well. So that's an idea we're exploring. It's by no means foolproof, and it wouldn't be a definitive answer, but to help our NESGP members know when they're about to suddenly be facing basically a financial penalty of some £1,000 would be a great thing for us to put into Bookkeeper, I believe. So that's from Liz Densley. Third article is on laughter and humour and how this is used in the consultation. And, you know, laughter is a great tool. It's a great balancer. We often will use it in a consultation. It can put people at their ease and it can make working a lot more fun. However, there are pitfalls. And again, so this article is from Rachel Birch from the Medical Protection Society, and this goes into some common sense advice, really, that don't, I guess, just don't necessarily try and introduce laughter or humour into every consultation, because obviously there are times when it's not appropriate. And one really salient point, I think, that Rachel, puts in here is that patients will often use humour because they're very scared, they're very worried, and they're doing it to mask their anxiety. And then, quite naturally, people then can respond again with cracking a joke, and then actually it's totally inappropriate because the patient is actually very anxious and is very serious and very worried, and this can lead to complaints. So the article goes into that, and really, I guess the salient point from this article is that when using humour, do it consciously. You know, make it as a conscious decision, which I think I'm going to find quite tough, because I certainly, when I use humour, I don't think I do it consciously. It's all very subconscious, and probably full of dad jokes as well. So there's some food for thought there. Next article is from Nigel Farrer from Legal and Medical. And this one, we asked Legal and Medical if they could do an article from... Look, we have lots and lots of parents as NESGP members. And we know this because there's an awful lot of maternity leave going on, which is wonderful. And a little known fact that if you are on maternity leave, your NESGP membership is totally, totally free. So if you're not a full member of the NESGP, ping us an email and you become a full member, and let us know when you're going back to work, so that during your maternity, should you wish to, you can again use full benefits of the NESGP website, the thousands of pages we've got, and of course our tools like Locum Deck to help you get work and organise that during your maternity leave, so you can just spend more time with your with your kids and less time fretting about that kind of thing. And also, if you are about to go on maternity leave or are a paying member and on maternity leave, let us know and we can put you onto that free membership. Of course, you can carry on paying if you want to, and we'd be delighted by that. But it's very much there if you need to. But this article is on financial tips, and there's five here. We asked it to be particularly family oriented, but for some reason the independent financial regulator couldn't sanction an article for that. For some reason, Lord knows why. I ain't a financial advisor, but I'm sure they're very good reasons. But it's the article is just general financial tips, and there's five here. One is about should you fall ill or should you die, how do you mitigate the risks for that? So things like critical illness cover and income protection cover, and what they involve. Another is setting up a rainy day fund. I'm sitting here in Prestine looking across the valley south to the Malverns, I think, and it has been pouring down this morning, but it's now clear blue sky and it's beautiful. So I'm kind of thinking of rainy day funds at the moment, but that's setting aside some period of time. And again, the article goes into that, of how much it's worth setting aside as a buffer zone should you just go ill and you're not enough time for your various income policies to kick in there. And of course, if you're an NESGP member, we do have a special offer for an income insurance, which is different. So this kicks in at 4 weeks and takes you up to the full 52 weeks post injury or illness, and will pay you a salary out of that. But more advice, and I'll put a link into that. I'll write that down. Put a link into that on this blog article that goes with this podcast. More advice on mortgages, and apparently this is the most commonly asked question, as the legal and medical get is from GP locums who want a mortgage, and they go into advice about that. There's one particular really interesting thing in this is about the child allowance, child maintenance allowance, I think it's called. And if you, so a married couple or a couple living together, you can get this allowance, but basically you've then got to pay it back to the government if your earnings are above a certain threshold at the end of the year. Or you can just say, no, look, I'm going to earn above the threshold, just don't bother paying me it, and I won't have to pay it back. Where Nigel's advice is here is that there are really good reasons on occasions to accept the payment. So it looks as though it's additional income, but various people can look at it as a cost or weighted as an income, and these are all relevant to where you are in your financial planning in terms of getting mortgages and that kind of thing. And then there's another tip here on childcare vouchers, and another one on getting your pension statements and making sure that, again, you're not paying too much into your pension scheme. Because if you are, that takes you again over a pension tier, see previous articles. That can give you a really good indicator of a time in your life when you can actually stop paying into the pension scheme, because you're effectively overpaying and it's actually starting to pretty much cost you. Then that heads us nicely into the Viper's Nest article by our very own Judith Harvey. And again, a great article on looking at poison and the animal world and insects, and looking at how the drug captopril, I never knew this, I know aspirin comes from willow trees. Yes, about it really. But I had no idea that captopril comes from the Brazilian pit viper. No idea. So this is about how animals have evolved, insects have evolved with all these various venoms and toxins, pretty much not to have nothing to do. They're not evolved for killing humans, they're for killing their normal prey. Yet every year, 100,000 people estimated die of a snake bite. Some 400,000 people have a limb amputated because of snake bites and venom stings. I read the other day that in Brazil, in cities, the death rate from scorpion bites has doubled in the last year or so through felling of trees and of forest and urbanisation. And the World Health Organization, Judith points out, has actually now made it one of its criteria that anti-venoms are essential drugs. But there's little profit in making these things. They're very expensive to make and store, and the people who most need these antitoxins have no access to them. And there's a lot of background here about the use of poisons over the years. Apparently there was some Iraqi tribes used to fill pots full of scorpions and throw them at enemies. This isn't a suggestion. It's historical fact. And also about how the pharma industry is looking at these, there are probably thousands, millions of different chemicals involved in all these toxins that have yet to be studied. Apparently, exenatide, the glucagon agonist, is a derivative of the Gila monster, which is some sort of antipodean lizard. And how there is other creatures like the Deathstalker scorpion, great name, and cone snails. I think there's those very weird-looking big snails you get. They've got various poisons. And there's even one, venom, it's a spider venom that causes priapism, which is being looked at as a potential treatment for impotence. So lots of interesting stuff in there, lots of food for thought from Judith, as always. And as always, Judith will listen to this podcast. She'll be listening now, and she'll then get in touch and say, "Hey, Richard, you said talked about we're going to do a podcast on this, so we'll book in for a podcast when we're back from Pristine with Judith on this article as well." And then finally, from Louise Hutman, a clinical summary of hearing loss and earwax from the recent NICE guidelines. And in this, Louise summarises her own personal learning points, that the information that she has certainly updated her understanding, but also Louise puts in a very pithy, very accessible format and summary. And again, that's all there. Interestingly, I didn't know this about NICE guidelines, and I know a lot of GP surgeries are now stopping ear syringing and recommending people doing it at home, but the NICE guidelines are saying that we should not be recommending that. Particularly, we tell patients not to stick cotton buds in their ears, so we certainly shouldn't be suggesting they squirt water at high pressure into their ears. The use of drops and the various efficacies or not of different varieties, hydrogen peroxide, olive oil, water, about the research that goes, the research about how long before we should be recommending patients put this stuff in their ears beforehand, before syringing, how we should be referring patients with dementia for hearing checks every couple of years, which I think is really good advice, and the need for urgent referrals in Asian and Chinese people who have middle ear effusion. So lots of good stuff in this August edition of the magazine. I really hope you enjoy it. It's online now, and I've got 24 hours as well to create the PDF version as well, because the version is currently in the iPad tablet, smartphone-friendly version. But I hope you enjoy it. Do email in. Do keep supporting the NESGP. It's great to have increasingly more and more members signing up. Fantastic uptake of the Locum Deck platform as well, and that we are getting tremendous feedback about that. Take a look at our NESGP's Sessional GP, Locum and Salary GP Facebook page, because that's got some great, some members have put some reviews of Locum Deck on that quite spontaneously, and so that's really wonderful. So I hope you enjoy the rest of your summer, and thank you for listening.